There's not a word for that in English, but Colin knew the French word.
Sillage.
What Colin liked about Curve was not its smell on the skin, but its sillage, the fruity, sweet smell of its leaving. Hassan sat down beside him in the tall grass, pushing hard at the cut.
Sorry I wouldn't take off my shirt.
Man boobs? Asked Colin.
Yeah, well, I just feel like I should know a girl a little before I trot out the man tits. Where are your glasses?
I was just asking myself that very question when the girl took her shirt off, Colin said.
So you couldn't see her?
I couldn't see her, just that her bra was purple.
Was it ever? Hassan replied.
And Colin thought of K-19 sitting over him on his bed wearing her purple bra as she dumped him. And he thought of Catherine the 14th, who wore a black bra and also a black everything else. And he thought of Catherine the 12th, the first who wore a bra, and all the Catherines whose bras he'd seen. 4, unless you count straps, in which case 7. People thought he was a glutton for punishment, that he liked getting dumped, but it wasn't like that. He could just never see anything coming, and as he lay on the solid, uneven ground with Hassan pressing too hard on his forehead, Colin Singleton's distance from his glasses made him realize the problem. Myopia. He was nearsighted. The future lay before him, inevitable, but invisible.
I found him,
Hassan said, and awkwardly tried to place the glasses on Colin's face. But it's hard to put glasses on someone else's head, and finally, Colin reached up and nudged them up the bridge of his own nose, and he could see.
Eureka, he said softly.
Catherine the 19th, the end of the end. She dumped him on the 8th day of the 12th month, just 22 days shy of their 1-year anniversary. They'd both graduated that morning, although from different schools, so Colin's and Catherine's parents, who were old friends, took them out to a celebratory lunch. But that evening was for them alone. Colin prepared by shaving and wearing that Wild Rain deodorant she liked so much that she'd nestle up against his chest to catch its scent. He'd picked her up in Satan's hearse, and they drove south down Lakeshore Drive, the windows down so they could hear, over the rumble of the engine, the waves of Lake Michigan beating against the rocky shore. Before them, the skyline towered. Colin had always loved Chicago's skyline. Although he was not a religious person, seeing the skyline made him feel what is called in Latin the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, that stomach-flipping mix of awestruck fear and entrancing fascination. They drove downtown, winding through the soaring buildings of Chicago's Loop, and they were already late because Catherine was always late to everything, and so after 10 minutes spent searching for a parking meter, Colin paid $18 for a garage spot, which annoyed Catherine.
I'm just saying we could have found a spot on the street, she said as she pressed the elevator button in the parking garage.
Well, I've got the money and we're late.
You shouldn't spend money you don't need to spend.
I'm about to spend $50 on sushi, he answered, for you.
The doors opened. Exasperated, he leaned against the wood paneling of the elevator and sighed. They hardly spoke until they were inside the restaurant, seated at a tiny table near the bathroom.
To graduating, and to a wonderful dinner, she said, raising her glass of Coke.
To the end of life as we've known it, Colin replied, and they clinked glasses.
Jesus, Colin, it's not the end of the world.
It's the end of a world, he pointed out.
Worried you won't be the smartest boy at Northwestern?
She smiled and then sighed. He felt a sudden twinge in his gut. In retrospect, it was the first hint that some piece of him might soon go missing.
Why are you sighing? He asked.
The waitress came then, interrupting with a rectangular plate of California maki and smoked salmon nigiri. Catherine pulled apart her chopsticks, and Colin grabbed his fork. He knew a little conversational Japanese, but chopsticks eluded him.
Why did you sigh? He asked again. Jesus, no reason.
No, just tell me why, he said.
You spend all your time worrying about losing your edge or getting dumped or whatever, and you're never for a second grateful. You're the valedictorian. You're going to a great school next year for free. So maybe you're not a child prodigy. That's good. At least you're not a child anymore. Or you're not supposed to be anyway.
Colin chewed.
He liked the seaweed wrapped around the sushi roll, how tough it was to chew, the subtleness of the ocean water.
"You don't understand," he said.
Catherine placed her chopsticks against the saucer containing her soy sauce and stared at him with something beyond frustration.
"Why do you always have to say that?"
"It's true," he said simply, and she didn't understand. She was still beautiful, still funny, still adept with chopsticks.
Prodigy was what Colin had, the way language has words. With all the nasty back and forth, Colin fought the urge to ask Catherine whether she still loved him, because the only thing she hated more than his saying she didn't understand was his asking whether she still loved him. He fought the urge, and fought it, and fought it. For 7 seconds.
"Do you still love me?" "Oh my God, Colin, please, we graduated, we're happy, celebrate."
"What, are you afraid to say it?"
"I love you."
She would never, not ever, tell him those words in that order, ever again.
"Can sushi be anagrammed?" she asked.
Sis, he answered immediately.
"Sis is 3 letters, sushi is 5, she said.
"No, sis. The and the sis. There are others, but they don't make grammatical sense." She smiled.
"Do you ever get tired of me asking?"
"No. No, I never get tired of anything you do," he said. And then he wanted to say he was sorry, but just that sometimes he felt ununderstandable, and sometimes he worried when they bickered and she went a while without saying she loved him, but he restrained himself. "Anyway, I like that sushi becomes a sis. Imagine a situation." Imagine a Situation was a game she'd invented where Colin found the anagrams and then Catherine imagined an anagrammatic situation.
"Okay," she said. "Okay, so a guy goes out fishing on the pier and he catches a carp. And of course it's all riddled with pesticides and sewage and all the nasty Lake Michigan shit. But he takes it home anyway because he figures if you fry a carp long enough it won't matter. He cleans it, fillets it, and then the phone rings, so he leaves it on the kitchen counter. He talks on the phone for a bit, and then he comes back into the kitchen and sees that his little sister has a big hunk of raw Lake Michigan carp in her hand, and she's chewing. And she looks up at her brother and says, 'Sushi!' And he says, 'Sis.'"
They laughed. He had never loved her so much as he did then. Later, after they tiptoed into the apartment, and Colin walked upstairs to tell his mom he was home, leaving out the possibly relevant information that he wasn't alone, and after they'd climbed into bed downstairs, and after she pulled off his shirt and he hers, and after they kissed until his lips were numb except for tingling, she said,
"Do you really feel sad about graduating?"
"I don't know. If I'd done it differently, if I'd gone to college at 10 or whatever, there's no way of knowing if my life would be better. We probably wouldn't be together. I wouldn't have known Hassan. And a lot of prodigies who push and push and push end up even more fugged up than me. But a few of them end up like John Locke or Mozart or whatever. And my chances at Mozartdom are done."
John Locke was a British philosopher and political scientist who could read and write in Latin and Greek before the rest of us can tie our shoes.
"Call, you're 17.
She sighed again. She sighed a lot, but nothing could be wrong, because it felt so good to have her nestled up against him, her head on his shoulder, his hand brushing the soft blonde hair from her face. He looked down and could see the strap of her purple bra.
"It's the tortoise and the hare, though, Kay. I learn faster than other people, but they keep learning. I've slowed down, and now they're coming.
Although you'll no doubt notice that Colin still doesn't quite get what the tortoise and the hare story is about, he had figured out by now that it was about more than a turtle and a rabbit.
"I know I'm 17, but I'm past my prime," she laughed.
"Seriously, there are studies about this shit. Prodigies tend to hit their peak at like 12 or 13. What have I done? I won a fucking game show a year ago. That's my indelible mark on human history?"
She sat up, looking down at him. He thought of her other size, the better and different ones of his body moving against hers. For a long time, she stared at him, and then she bit her lower lip and said, "Colin, maybe the problem is us."
"Oh, shit," he said. And so it began.
This is the end of disc number one. Please continue listening on disc number two. This is disc number two.
Catherine sat up, looking down at him. He thought of her other size, the better and different ones of his body moving against hers. For a long time she stared at him, and then she bit her lower lip and said,
"Colin, maybe the problem is us."
"Oh, shit," he said. And so it began. The end occurred mostly in her whispers and his silence, because he couldn't whisper, and they didn't want to wake Colin's parents. They succeeded in staying quiet, in part because it felt like the air had been shocked out of him. Paradoxically, he felt as if his getting dumped was the only thing happening on the entire dark and silent planet, and also as if it weren't happening at all. He felt himself drifting away from the one-sided whispered conversation, wondering if maybe everything big and heartbreaking and incomprehensible is a paradox. He was a dying man, staring down on the surgeons trying to save him. With an almost comfortable distance from the thing itself as it really was, Colin thought about the dork mantra, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." What a dirty lie. This, right here, was the true abdominal snowman. It felt like something freezing in his stomach.
"I love you so much, and I just want you to love me like I love you," he said as softly as he could. "You don't need a girlfriend, Colin. You need a robot who says nothing but I love you."
And it felt like being stoned and sticked from the inside, a fluttering and then a sharp pain in his lower ribcage, and then he felt for the first time that a piece of his gut had been wrenched out of him. She tried to get out as quickly and painlessly as possible, but after she begged curfew, he began to cry. She held his head against her collarbone. And even though he felt pitiful and ridiculous, he didn't want it to end, because he knew the absence of her would hurt more than any breakup ever could. But she left anyway, and he was alone in his room, searching out anagrams for "my missing piece" in a vain attempt to fall asleep. Chapter 6. It always happened like this. He would look and look for the keys to Satan's hearse, and then finally he'd just give up and say, "Fine, I'll take the fugging bus," and on his way out the door he'd see the keys. Keys show up when you reconcile yourself to the bus. Catherines appear when you start to disbelieve the world contains another Catherine, and sure enough, the eureka moment arrived just as he began to accept it would never come. He felt the thrill of it surge through him, his eyes blinking fast as he fought to remember the idea in its completeness. Lying there on his back in the sticky, thick air, the eureka moment felt like a thousand orgasms all at once, except not as messy.
"Eureka?" Hassan asked, the excitement evident in his voice. He'd been waiting for it, too. "I need to write this down," Colin said.
He sat up. His head hurt like hell, but he reached into his pocket and pulled out the little notebook he kept at all times and a number 2 pencil, which was broken in the middle from his fall, but still wrote okay. He sketched a graph with a curve that climbed steeply from below the x-axis and just to the left of the y-axis to a slightly rounded high peak to the right of the y-axis, followed by a slight dip, a pause, then a precipitous, nearly vertical plunge to a point below the x-axis. He wrote, "Where x equals time, and y equals happiness. Y equals 0, beginning of relationship and breakup. Y negative equals breakup by M, and y positive equals breakup by F. My relationship with K-19. He was still sketching when he heard Lindsay Lee Wells coming and opened his eyes to see her wearing a fresh t-shirt. It read, "Gutshot!"
and toting a first aid box with an honest-to-God red cross on it. She knelt beside him and pulled the T-shirt off his head slowly, and then she said, "This is going to sting," and dug into the cut with a long Q-tip soaked in what seemed to be cayenne pepper sauce. "Ugh!" shouted Colin, wincing, and he looked up and saw her round brown eyes blinking away sweat as she worked. "I know, I'm sorry, okay, it's done. You don't need stitches, but you're going to have a little scar, I bet. Is that okay?" "What's another scar?" he said absentmindedly, as she pulled a wide gauze bandage taut against his forehead. "I feel like someone punched me in the brain." "Possible concussion," Lindsay noted. "What day is it? Where are you?"
"It's Tuesday, and I'm in Tennessee."
"Who was the junior senator from New Hampshire in 1873? Asked Hassan.
"Bainbridge Wadley," answered Colin.
"I don't think I have a concussion."
"Is that for real?" asked Lindsay. "I mean, did you really know that?"
Colin nodded slowly.
"Yeah," he said, "I know all the senators. Also, that's an easy one to remember, because I always think about how much your parents have to fucking hate you to name you Bainbridge Wadley."
"Seriously," said Hassan. "I mean, you've already got the last name Wadley. That's a bad sitch just to be a Wadley. But then you take that Wadley and you raise it to the power of Bainbridge? No wonder the poor bastard never became president."
Lindsay added, "Well, but then again a guy named Millard Fillmore became president. No loving mother would ever make a Fillmore a Millard either."
She fell into conversation with them so quickly and so naturally that Colin was already revising his celebrity living theorem. He'd always thought people in Nowhere, Tennessee would be, well, dumber than Lindsay Lee Wells. Hassan sat down next to Colin and grabbed the notebook from him. He held it above his head to block the sun, which had darted out from behind a cloud to further bake the cracked orange dirt. Hassan only glanced at the paper before saying,
"You just got me all riled up and your big revelation is that you like getting dumped? Shit, Colin, I could have told you that. In fact, I have."
"Love is graphable," Colin said defensively.
"Wait."
Hassan looked down at the paper again, and then back to Colin.
"Universally? You're claiming this will work for anyone?"
"Right, because relationships are so predictable, right?
Well, I'm finding a way to predict them.
Take any two people, and even if they've never met each other, the formula will show who's going to break up with whom if they ever date, and approximately how long the relationship will last."
"Impossible," Hassan said.
"No, it's not, because you can see into the future if you have a basic understanding of how people are likely to act."
Hassan's long and slow exhalation broke into a whisper.
"Yeah. Okay. That's interesting."
Hassan could give Colin no higher compliment. Lindsay Lee Wells reached down and grabbed the notebook from Hassan. She read it slowly. Finally, she said,
"What the hell is K-19?
Colin put a hand down in the caked, dry earth and pushed himself up.
"The what's a who," he answered.
"Catherine the 19th. I've dated 19 girls named Catherine."
Lindsay Lee Wells and Colin stared at each other dead in the eye for a very long time, until finally her smile collapsed into a gentle laugh.
"What?" Colin asked.
She shook her head but couldn't stop laughing.
"Nothing," she said. "Let's go see the Archduke."
"No, tell me," he said insistently. He didn't like secrets kept from him. Being on the outside of something annoyed him more than it should have, really.
"It's nothing, just... I've only dated one boy."
"Why's that funny?" Colin asked.
"It's funny," she explained, "because his name is Colin."
The middle of the beginning. By third grade, his failure to achieve sociological well-being had become so obvious to everyone that Colin attended regular school at Kalman only 3 hours a day. The rest of his day was spent with his lifelong tutor, Keith Carter, who drove a Volvo with the license plate Crazy. Keith was one of those guys who never grew out of his ponytail. He also maintained, or, as the case was, failed to maintain, a thick, broad mustache that extended to his lower lip when his mouth was closed, which was very rarely the case. Keith enjoyed talking. and his favorite audience was Colin Singleton. Keith was a friend of Colin's dad and a psychology professor. His interest in Colin wasn't exactly unselfish. Over the years, Keith would publish a number of articles about Colin's prodigy. Colin liked being so special that scholars would take note of him. And also, Crazy Keith was the closest thing Colin had to a best friend. Every day, Keith drove down to the city, and he and Colin went to a broom closet of an office on the third floor of the Coleman School. Colin pretty much got to read whatever he wanted in silence for the next 4 hours, with Keith occasionally breaking in to discuss something, and then on Fridays, they'd spend the day talking about what Colin had learned. Colin liked it a great deal better than regular school. For one thing, Keith never gave him an abdominal snowman. Crazy Keith had a daughter, Catherine, who was Colin's year in school, but 8 months older in actual life. She went to a school north of the city, but every so often, Colin's parents would have Crazy Keith and his wife and Catherine over to dinner to discuss Colin's progress and the like. And then, after those dinners, the parents would sit in the living room, laughing louder as time passed, Keith shouting that he couldn't possibly drive home, that he needed a cup of coffee after all that wine. "Your home is an Alamo for enophiles," he'd cry. One night in November of his third grade year, after it got cold but before his mom put up the holiday decorations, Catherine came over. After a dinner of lemon chicken and brown rice, Colin and Catherine went into the living room, where Colin lay across the couch and studied Latin. He had just recently learned that President Garfield, who was not even particularly noted for his intelligence, had been able to write simultaneously in Latin and Greek, Latin with his left hand and Greek with his right. Colin intended to match this feat, but never did, because try as he might, he just wasn't ambidextrous. Catherine, a tiny blonde with both her father's ponytail and his fascination with prodigies, sat watching him quietly. Colin was aware of her, but it did not distract him because people often watched him when he studied, like there was some secret in his approach to academia. The secret, in truth, was that he just spent more time studying and paid more attention than everyone else.
"How come you learned Latin already?" "I study hard," he answered. "Why?"
she asked, coming over to sit by his feet on the couch.
"I like it."
"Why?" she asked. He paused for a moment. Unfamiliar with the why game, he took her question seriously.
"I like it because it makes me different and better, and because I'm quite good at it."
"Why?"
she asked, her voice singing the monosyllable, almost smiling.
"Your dad says it's because I remember things better than other people on account of how I pay very close attention and care very much."
"Why?"
"Because it is important to know things. For example, I just recently learned that Roman Emperor Vitellius once ate 1,000 oysters in one day, which is a very impressive act of obligation," he said, using a word he felt sure Catherine wouldn't know.
It is an actual, if very obscure, English word, which means the spending of too much money on food.
"And also, it is important to know things because it makes you special and you can read books that normal people cannot read, such as Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is in Latin."
"Why?"
"Because he lived in Rome when they spoke and wrote Latin."
"Why?"
And that one tripped him up. Why had Ovid lived in ancient Rome in 20 BCE and not Chicago in 2006 CE? One no longer says AD or BC. It's just not hip anymore. These days, one says either CE for Common Era or BCE for Before Common Era. Would Ovid still have been Ovid if he had lived in America? No, he wouldn't have been, because he would have been a Native American, or possibly an American Indian, or a first person, or an indigenous person, and they did not have Latin or any other kind of written language then. So, did Ovid matter because he was Ovid, or because he lived in ancient Rome?
"That," Colin said, "is a very good question, and I will try to find out the answer for you,"
he said, which is what Crazy Keith said when Crazy Keith did not know an answer.
"Do you want to be my boyfriend?" Catherine asked.
Colin sat up quickly and looked at her, her bright blue eyes staring down into her lap. He would come, eventually, to call her the Great One, Catherine the First, Catherine the Magnificent. Even seated, she was noticeably shorter than he, and she looked quite serious and nervous. Her lips pulled in tight as she looked down. Something surged through him. The nerve endings exploded into shivers on his skin. His diaphragm fluttered. And of course, it couldn't have been lust or love, and it didn't feel like, so it must have been what the kids at school called like. And he said,
"Yes. Yes, I do."
She turned to him, her face round and her cheeks full and freckled, and she leaned toward him, her lips pursed, and she kissed him on the cheek. It was his first kiss, and her lips felt like the coming winter, cold and dry and chapped. And it occurred to Colin that the kiss didn't feel nearly as good as the sound of her asking if he wanted to be her boyfriend. Chapter 7. Quite out of nowhere, just over the crest of a tiny slope, the grassy field broke out into a graveyard. It contained perhaps 40 gravestones and was surrounded by a knee-high stone wall covered in slippery moss.
"This would be the last and final resting place of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand," Lindsay Lee Wells said, her voice suddenly affected with a new cadence, that of the bored tour guide who long ago memorized her speech.
Colin and Hassan followed her to a 6-foot-tall obelisk, a kind of miniature Washington monument, before which lay a plethora of not new pink silk roses. Though obviously fake, the flowers still seemed wilted. Lindsay sat down on the mossy wall.
"Ah, screw the speech. You probably already know this anyway," she said, nodding toward Colin. "But I'll tell the story. The Archduke was born in December 1863 in Austria. His uncle was the Emperor Francis Joseph, but being the Austro-Hungarian Emperor's nephew don't matter much. Unless, say, the Emperor's only son, Rudolf, happens to shoot himself in the head, which is what, in fact, happened in 1889. All of a sudden, Franz Ferdinand was next in line for the throne."
"They called Franz the loneliest man in Vienna," Colin said to Hassan.
"Yeah, well, no one liked him because he was a total nerd," Lindsay said. "Except he was one of those nerds who isn't even very smart. Your average inbred 96-pound weakling type. His family thought he was a liberal wuss. Viennese society thought he was an idiot, like an actual tongue-hanging-out-of-your-mouth idiot. And then he went and made matters worse by marrying for love. He married this girl named Sophie in 1900, and everyone thought she was just totally low rent. But, you know, in the guy's defense, he really loved her. That's what I never tell in the tour, but from everything I've read about Francie, he and Sophie had about the happiest marriage in the whole history of royalty. It's sort of a cute story, except for how on their 14th wedding anniversary, June 28, 1914, they were both shot dead in Sarajevo. The emperor had them buried outside of Vienna. He didn't even bother to attend the funeral. But he cared enough about his nephew to go ahead and start World War I, which he did by declaring war on Serbia a month later."
She stood up. "Thus ends the tour." She smiled. "Tips are appreciated." Colin and Hassan clapped politely, and then Colin walked over to the obelisk, which read only, "Archduke Franz Ferdinand, 1863-1914. Lie lightly upon him, earth, though he laid many a heavy burden upon thee." Heavy burdens indeed. Millions of them. Colin reached out and felt the granite, cool despite the hot sun. And what had the Archduke Franz Ferdinand done that he might have done differently? If he hadn't obsessed over love, hadn't been so tactless, so whiny, so nerdy, maybe if he hadn't been, Colin thought, so much like me. In the end, the Archduke had two problems. No one gave a shit about him, at least not till his corpse started a war, and one day he got a piece taken out of his middle. But now, Colin would fill his own hole and make people stand up and take notice of him. He would stay special, use his talent to do something more interesting and important than anagramming and translating Latin. And yes, again the eureka washed over him, the yes, yes, yes of it. He would use his past and the Archduke's past and the whole endless past to inform the future. He would impress Catherine the 19th. She had always loved the idea of him being a genius. And he would make the world safer to dumpies everywhere. He would matter. From which reverie he was awoken by Hassan asking,
"So, how the fuck did a perfectly good Austrian Archduke end up in Schittsburg, Tennessee?"
"We bought him," Lindsay Lee Wells said. "Around 1921, The owner of the castle where he was buried needed money and put him up for sale, and we bought him.
How much did a dead archduke cost in those days? Hassan wondered.
About 3,500 bucks, they say.
That's a lot of money, Colin said, his hands still on the granite obelisk. The dollar rose by a factor of more than 10 between 1920 and now, so that's more than $35,000 in today's dollars. A lot of tours at 11 bucks apiece.
Lindsay Lee Wells rolled her eyes.
Okay, I'm sufficiently impressed. Enough already. You know, we got these things down here. I don't know if you have them where you're from, but they're called calculators, and they can do all that work for you.
I wasn't trying to impress anyone, Colin insisted defensively. And then Lindsay's eyes lit up, and she cupped her hands over her mouth and shouted, "Hey!" Three guys and one girl were trudging up the slope, just their heads visible.
Kids from school, Lindsay explained, and my boyfriend.
Lindsay Lee Wells took off running toward them. Hassan and Colin stood still and began chatting quickly back and forth.
Hassan said, "I'm a Kuwaiti exchange student. My dad's an oil baron."
Colin shook his head. "Too obvious. I'm a Spaniard, a refugee. My parents were murdered by Basque separatists."
"I don't know if Basque is a thing or a person, and neither will they, so no. Okay, I just got to America from Honduras. My name is Miguel. My parents made a fortune in bananas, and you are my bodyguard because the Banana Workers Union wants me dead."
Colin shot back, "That's good, but you don't speak Spanish.
Okay, I was abducted by Eskimos in the Yukon No, that's crap. We're cousins, from France, visiting the United States for the first time. It's our high school graduation trip."
"That's boring, but we're out of time. I'm the English speaker?"
asked Hassan.
"Yeah, fine."
By now, Colin could hear the group chatting and see Lindsay Lee Wells' eyes staring up at a tall, muscular boy wearing a Tennessee Titans jersey. The boy was a hulking mass of muscle, with spiked hair and a smile that was all top teeth and gums. The success of the game depended on Lindsay having not talked about Colin and Hassan, but Colin figured it was a safe bet, as she seemed pretty enthralled with the boy.
"Okay, they're coming," said Hassan. "What's your name?"
"Pierre."
"Okay, I'm Salinger, pronounced Salinger."
"Y'all here for the tour, are you?" Lindsay's boyfriend said.
"Yes, I am Salinger,"
Hassan said, his accent passable if not magnificent.
"This is my cousin Pierre. We visit your country for the first time. We wish to see the Archduke who started our, how you say, first Earth War."
Colin glanced at Lindsay Lee Wells, who suppressed a smile as she smacked orange gum.
"I'm Colin," the boyfriend said, his hand extended.
Hassan leaned over to Pierre/Colin and whispered,
"His name is the other Colin."
Hassan then said,
"My cousin, he speak very little English. I am his man of translate."
The other Colin laughed, as did the other two boys, who quickly introduced themselves as Chase and Fulton.
"We will call Chase, jeans are too tight, and Fulton shall be short one chewing tobacco,"
Hassan whispered to Colin.
"Je m'appelle Pierre,"
Colin blurted out after the boys had introduced themselves.
"Quand je vais dans le métro, je fais aussi de la musique de prout."
Which means, "My name is Pierre. When I go to the metro, I also make fart music."
"We get a lot of foreign tourists here,"
said the only girl besides Lindsay, who was tall and thoroughly Abercrombified in her tight tank top. The girl also had, how to put this politely, gigantic gazumbas. She was incredibly hot, in that popular girl with bleached teeth and anorexia kind of way, which was Colin's least favorite way of being hot.
"I'm Katrina, by the way."
Close, Colin thought, but no cigar.
"Amour, M-Emmy, amour,"
Colin announced quite loudly, which means "love loves to love love," a quote translated into French from James Joyce's Ulysses.
"Pierre," said Hassan, "he has the disease with the talking, with the bad words. In France, we say Tourette's. I do not know how you say in English."
"He has Tourette's?" asked Katrina.
"Merde!"
shouted Colin.
"Yes," said Hassan excitedly. "Same word, both language, like hemorrhoid. That one we learned yesterday, because Pierre had the fire in his bottom. He has the Tourette's and the hemorrhoids, but he's good boy.
Ne dis pas que j'ai des hemorrhoids. Je n'ai pas d'hemorrhoides.
Colin shouted, at once trying to continue the game and get Hassan onto a different topic. Hassan looked at Colin, nodded knowingly, and then told Katrina,
He just said that your face, it is beautiful, like the hemorrhoid.
At which point, Lindsay Lee Wells burst out laughing and said, Okay, okay, enough. Colin turned to Hassan and said,
Why'd it have to be hemorrhoids? How the hell did that idea pop into your mind?
And then the other Colin, T-O-C, talk, and jeans are too tight, J-A-T-T, jat, and short one chewing tobacco, S-O-C-T, socked, and Katrina were all abuzz, talking and laughing and asking Lindsay questions.
My dad went to France last year, dude, explained Hassan, and he told this story about getting a hemorrhoid and having to point at his butt and say the French word for fire over and over again until it came out that the word was hemorrhoid in both languages. And I didn't know any other fugging French words. Plus, that's some funny shit, you having Tourette's and hemorrhoids.
Whatever, Colin said, his face flushed. And then he overheard Talk saying,
That's awful funny. Hollis would love them, huh?
And Lindsay laughed and reached up on her tiptoes to kiss him and then said,
I got you good, baby.
And he said, Well, they got me. And Lindsay faked like she was pouting. And Talk leaned down to kiss her forehead, and she brightened. The same scene had played out in Colin's own life frequently, although he'd usually been the fake pouter. They trudged back through the field as a group, Colin's sweat-soaked T-shirt sticky and tight against his back, his eye still throbbing. The theorem of underlying Catherine predictability, he thought. Even the name rang true. He had waited so long for his breakthrough, despaired so many times, and he just wanted to be alone for a little while with a pencil and some paper and a calculator and no talking. In the car would work. Colin tugged softly on Hassan's shirt and gave him a meaningful look.
I just need some Gatorade, Hassan responded. Then we'll go.
I need to open up the store for you then, Lindsay said.
She turned to talk.
Come with me, baby.
The gooey softness of her voice reminded Colin of K-19.
I would, Talk said, except Hollis is sitting out on the steps. Me and Chase is supposed to be at work, but we skipped out.
Talk picked her off her feet and squeezed her tight, his biceps flexing. She squirmed a little but kissed him hard, her mouth open. Then he dropped her down, winked, and trudged off with his entourage toward a red pickup truck. When Lindsay, Hassan, and Colin arrived back at the Gutshot General Store, a large woman wearing a pink floral dress was sitting on the steps, talking to a man with a bushy brown beard. As they approached, Colin could hear the woman telling a story.
So Starnes is out there to mow the lawn, she was saying, and he turns off the mower and looks up and appraises the situation for a bit, and then he calls out to me, Hollis, what the hell is wrong with that dog? And I says to him, that dog's got inflamed anal sacs that I just drained. And Starnes chews that one over for a while. And then finally he says, I reckon you could go ahead and shoot that dog and get you another one with regular anal sacs and wouldn't nobody be the wiser. And I tell him, Starnes, this town ain't got any men worth loving, so I might as well love my dog.
The bearded guy bent over in laughter, and then the storyteller looked over at Lindsay.
You were on a tour? Hollis asked.
When Lindsay nodded, Hollis went on.
Well, you sure God took your time.
Sorry, mumbled Lindsay. Nodding to the guys, she said, Hollis, this is Hassan and Colin. Boys, this is Hollis.
Also known as Lindsay's mother, Hollis explained.
Christ, Hollis, don't go bragging about it, Lindsay said.
She walked past her mom, unlocked the store, and everyone walked into the sweet air conditioning. As Colin passed, Hollis put a hand on his shoulder, spun him around, and stared at his face.
I know you, she said.
I don't know you, Colin responded, and then added by way of explanation, I don't forget many faces.
Hollis Wells continued to stare at him, but he was sure they had never met.
He means that literally, Hassan added, peering up from behind a rack of comic books. Do you guys get newspapers here?
From behind the counter, Lindsay Lee Wells produced a USA Today.
Hassan paged through the front section and finally folded the paper carefully to reveal only a small black-and-white picture of a thick-haired, bespectacled white male.
"Do you know this guy?"
Hassan asked. Colin squinted at the paper and thought for a moment.
"I don't personally know him, but his name is Gil Stable, and he is the CEO of a company called Fortiscom."
"Good work, except he's not the CEO of Fortiscom."
"Yes, he is," Colin said, quite confident.
"No, he's not. He's not the CEO of anything. He's dead."
Hassan unfolded the paper, and Colin leaned in to read the caption. "Fortiscom CEO dies in plane crash."
"Cranial, kids!"
Hollis shouted triumphantly. Colin looked up at her wide-eyed. He sighed. No one watched that show. Its Nielsen share was 0.0. The show had been on for one season, and not a single soul among Chicago's 3 million residents had ever recognized him. And yet, here, in Gutshot, Tennessee.
"Oh my God!"
Hollis shouted.
"What are you doing here?"
Colin, flushed for a moment with a feeling of famousness, thought about it.
"I cracked up. Then we went on a road trip. Then we saw a sign for the Archduke. Then I cut my head. Then I had a eureka moment. Then we met her friends. Now we're going back to the car, but we haven't left yet."
Hollis stepped forward and examined his bandage. She smiled and with one hand reached up for his Jew-fro and mussed his hair like she was his aunt and he was a 7-year-old who'd just done something exceedingly cute.
"You're not leaving yet either," she said, "because I'm going to cook you dinner."
Hassan clapped his hands together.
"I am hungry." "Close her down, Linz."
Lindsay rolled her eyes and walked slowly out from behind the register.
"You drive with Colin in case he gets lost," Hollis told Lindsay. "I'll take... what did you say your name was?" "I'm not a terrorist," Hassan said by way of answering.
"Well, that's a relief."
Hollis smiled. Hollis drove a new and impressively pink pickup truck, and Colin followed in the hearse with Lindsay riding shotgun.
"Nice car," she said sarcastically.
Colin didn't respond. He liked Lindsay Lee Wells, but sometimes it felt like she was trying to get his goat, which is what Colin's mom always called teasing, even though it never made a lick of sense to Colin. He had the same problem with Hassan.
"Thanks for not saying anything when I was Pierre and Hassan was Salinger."
"Yeah, well, it was pretty funny. And plus, Colin was being sort of a dick and needed to be taken down a peg."
"I see," said Colin, which is what he had learned to say when he had nothing to say.
"So," she said, "you're a genius?"
"I'm a washed-up child prodigy," Colin said.
"What are you good at, other than just already knowing everything?"
Languages, word games, trivia, nothing useful."
He felt her glance at him.
"Languages are useful. What do you speak?"
"I'm pretty good in 11. German, French, Latin, Greek, Dutch, Arabic, Spanish, Russian."
"I get the picture," she said, cutting him off. "I think that meine Mutter denkt, dass sie für mich gut sind,"
she said, meaning, "My mother thinks that you are good for me."
"That's why we're in this car together."
"Warum denkt sie das?"
Which means, "Why would she think that?"
"Okay, we've both proven we speak German. She's been on my ass like crazy to go to college and become, I don't know, a doctor or something. Only I'm not going, I'm staying here. I already made up my mind about that. So I'm thinking maybe she wants you to inspire me or something."
"Doctors make more money than paramedics in training," Colin pointed out.
"Right, but I don't need money."
She paused, and the car rumbled beneath them. Finally, he glanced over at her.
"I need my life," she explained, "which is good and which is here. Anyway, I might go to the community college in Bradford to shut Hollis up, but that's it."
The road took a sharp, banked turn to the right, and past a stand of trees, a town emerged. Small but well-kept houses lined the road. They all had porches, it seemed, and a lot of people were sitting out on them, even though it was hotter than hell in summertime. On the main road, Colin noted a newish combination gas station and Taco Bell, a hair salon, and the Gutshot, Tennessee post office, which appeared from the road to be the size of a spacious walk-in closet. Lindsay pointed out Colin's window.
"Out there's the factory," she said,
and in the middle distance, Colin saw a complex of low-lying buildings. It didn't look much like a factory. No towering steel silos or smokestacks billowing carbon monoxide, just a few buildings that vaguely reminded him of airplane hangars. "What does it make?" Colin asked.
"It makes jobs. It makes all the good jobs this town has. My great-grandfather started the plant in 1917.
Colin slowed down, pulling to the shoulder so that a speeding SUV could pass him while he looked out at the factory with Lindsay.
"Right, but what gets made there?" he asked. "You'll laugh."
"I won't laugh."
"Swear not to laugh," she said.
"I swear."
"It's a textile mill. These days we mostly make, tampon strings."
Colin did not laugh. Instead, he thought,
"Tampons have strings? Why?"
Of all the major human mysteries, God, the nature of the universe, etc., he knew the least about tampons. To Colin, tampons were a little bit like grizzly bears. He was aware of their existence, but he'd never seen one in the wild and didn't really care to. In lieu of Colin's laugh came a period of unbreachable silence. He followed Hollis's pink truck down a newly paved side street that sloped up precipitously, causing the hearse's worn-out engine to rev for its very life. As they climbed the hill, it became clear that the street was actually a long driveway, which dead-ended into the largest single-family residence that Colin had ever personally laid eyes upon. Also, it was glaringly, bubblegummingly, Pepto-Bismol-y pink. He pulled into the driveway. Colin was staring at it somewhat slack-jawed when Lindsay poked him softly on the arm. Lindsay shrugged as if embarrassed.
"It ain't much," she said, "but it's home."
A broad staircase led to a heavily columned front porch. Hollis opened the door and Colin and Hassan walked into a cavernous living room, outfitted with a couch long enough for both of them to lie down without touching.
"Y'all make yourselves at home. Lindsay and I are going to get dinner ready."
"You can probably handle that on your own," Lindsay said, leaning against the front door.
"I probably could, but I ain't gonna."
Hassan sat down on the couch.
"That Hollis is a riot, man. On the way over here, she was telling me that she owns a factory that makes tampon strings."
Colin still did not find this fact particularly hilarious.
"You know," Colin said, "the movie star Jane Mansfield lived in a pink mansion."
He walked around the living room, reading the spines of Hollis's books and looking at framed photographs. A picture on the mantel above their fireplace caught Colin's eye, and he walked over to it. A slightly younger, slightly thinner Hollis was standing in front of Niagara Falls. Beside her stood a girl who looked a little like Lindsay Lee Wells, except the girl wore a black trench coat over a ratty old Blink 182 t-shirt. Her eyeliner was thick and stretched back toward her temples, her black jeans tight and tapered, her Doc Martens well polished.
"Does she have a sister?" asked Colin.
"What?"
"Lindsay," Colin elaborated. "Come here and look at this."
Hassan came over and briefly appraised the picture before saying,
"That's the most pathetic attempt I've ever seen to be goth. Goth kids don't like Blink 182. God, even I know that."
"Do you like green beans?"
Lindsay asked, and Colin suddenly realized she was behind them.
"Is this your sister?" asked Colin.
No, she said to Colin. "I'm an only child. Can't you tell by how adorably self-involved I am?"
"He was too busy being adorably self-involved to notice," Hassan interjected.
"So who is this?" Colin asked Lindsay.
"It's me in eighth grade."
"Oh," said Colin and Hassan simultaneously, both embarrassed.
"Yeah, I like green beans,"
Hassan said, trying to change the subject as quickly as possible. Lindsay pulled shut the kitchen door behind her, and Hassan shrugged toward Colin and smirked, then returned to the couch.
"I need to work," Colin said.
He found his way down a pink wallpapered hallway and into a room with a huge wooden desk that looked like the kind of place where a president might sign a bill into law. Colin sat down, pulled from his pocket his broken No. 2 pencil and omnipresent notebook, and began to scribble. "The theorem rests upon the validity of my long-standing argument that the world contains precisely two kinds of people, dumpers and dumpees. Everyone is predisposed to being either one or the other, but of course not all people are complete dumpers or dumpees, hence the bell curve.
and he drew a curve centered on a vertical axis, the left side labeled Dumper, the right side labeled Dumpy. His caption read, "The majority of people fall somewhere close to the vertical dividing line, with the occasional statistical outlier, e.g. me, representing a tiny percentage of overall individuals." And then he sought a graphable equation that would express his relationship with the Great One, the simplest of all his romances, as it actually was, nasty, brutish, and short. For some reason, as he discarded equations left and right, the room seemed to grow warmer. Sweat pooled in the gauze bandage over his eyes, so he tore it off. He removed his shirt, wiping still trickling blood from his face. Naked from the waist up, his vertebrae extruded from his skinny back as he hunched over the desk, working. He felt as he had never felt before, that he was close to an original concept. Plenty of people, Colin included, had noted the dumper-dumpy dichotomy before, but no one had ever used it to show the arc of romantic relationships. He doubted anyone had ever even imagined that a single formula could predict the rise and fall of romances universally. He knew it wouldn't be easy. For one thing, turning concepts into numbers was a sort of anagramming to which he was unaccustomed. But he had confidence. He'd certainly never been all that good at math, although of course he was certainly better than most people, but he was a goddamned world-famous expert in getting dumped. He kept at the formula, haunted by the feeling that his head was just about to wrap around something big and important. And when he proved he mattered, she would miss him, he knew. She would see him as she had in the beginning, as a genius. Within an hour, he had an equation. The f of x equals d cubed x squared minus d, which made Catherine I look like this, a narrow inverted U, the top of the U at plus 1 on the y-axis, and the ends crossing the x-axis at approximately negative 1 and positive 1. That was nearly perfect, an uncomplicated graphical representation of an uncomplicated relationship. It even captured the relationship's brevity. The graphs didn't need to represent time accurately. They merely needed to give an idea of length by comparison. For example, she'll date me longer than K-14, but not as long as K-19. A fuller explanation of the math involved here would be really boring and also really long. But then, Catherine II came out all wrong, only touching the x-axis once. Clearly, it wasn't refined enough yet to send out a notice to the annals of mathematics or anything, but Colin felt good enough to slink back into his shirt. Happier than he'd been in, well, at least 2 days, Colin hurried down the hallway and burst into the coolness of the living room, where he saw through a door that Lindsay and Hassan and Hollis were seated in the dining room. He walked in and sat down before a plate of rice, green beans, and what appeared to be very small chickens. Hassan was laughing about something, and so were both the Wellses. Already, they seemed to love him. People just liked Hassan, the way people like fast food and celebrities. It was a gift Colin found amazing. The moment Colin sat down, Hollis asked Hassan, "Would you like to say grace?" "Sure thing." Hassan cleared his throat. "Bismillah." Then he picked up his fork. "That's it?" Hollis wondered. "That's it. We are a terse people. Terse and also hungry." The Arabic seemed to render everyone uncomfortable or something, because no one talked for a few minutes except Hassan, who kept saying that the quail, it was quail, not tiny chicken, was excellent. And it was good, Colin supposed, if you happened to enjoy searching through an endless labyrinth of bones and cartilage for the occasional sliver of meat. He hunted around with his fork and knife for the edible parts and finally located one entire bite of meat. He chewed slowly so as to relish it, chewing and chewing and... Ouch! Christ, what the hell was that? Chew, chew, chew. And again! Bug! Is that a bone? Ow, he said softly. Birdshot, Lindsay told him. Birdshot? Birdshot, Hollis agreed. The bird was shot? Colin asked, spitting out a tiny metal pellet. Yep. And I'm eating the bullets? Lindsay smiled. Nope, you're spitting them out. And so it was that Colin dined that evening primarily on rice and green beans. After everyone had finished, Hollis asked,
So, how did it feel to win Cranial Kids? I remember on the show you didn't seem that, excited.
I felt really bad about the other kid losing. She was really nice, the kid I played against. She took it kinda hard.
I was happy enough for the both of us, Hassan said. I was the only member of the studio audience dancing a jig. Singleton beat that little fugger like she'd stole something.
Stolen something, Colin wanted to say, but grammar isn't interesting. Cranial Kids reminded Colin of Catherine the 19th, and he stared straight ahead and tried hard to think of as little as possible. When Hollis spoke, it seemed to break a long quiet, the way alarm clocks do.
I think y'all should work for me this summer in Gutshot. I'm starting a project and you'd be perfect for it.
Over the years, people had occasionally sought to employ Colin in a manner befitting his talents, but A, summers were for Smart Kid Camp so that he could further his learning, and B, a real job would distract him from his real work, which was becoming an ever larger repository of knowledge, and C, Colin didn't really have any marketable skills. One rarely comes across, for instance, the following want ad. Prodigy. Huge megalithic corporation seeks a talented, ambitious prodigy to join our exciting, dynamic prodigy division for summer job. Requirements include at least 14 years experience as a certified child prodigy, ability to anagram adeptly and alliterate agilely, fluency in 11 languages. Job duties include reading, remembering encyclopedias, novels, and poetry, and memorizing the first 99 digits of pi. Which Colin did when he was 10. By making up a 99-word sentence in which the first letter of each word corresponded to the digit of pi, a equals 1, b equals 2, etc., j equals 0. The sentence, if you're curious. Catfish always drink alcoholic ether if begged, for every catfish enjoys heightened intoxication. Gross indulgence can be calamitous, however. Duly, garfish babysit for dirty catfish children, helping catfish babies get instructional education just because garfish get delight assisting infants' growth, and famously inspire confidence in immature catfish, giving experience and joy even. However, blowfish jeer insightful garfish, disparaging inappropriately, doing damage, even insulting benevolent, charming, jovial garfish, hurting and frustrating deeply. Joy fades, but hurt feelings bring just grief. Inevitable irritation hastens feeling blue. However, jovial children declare happiness. Blowfish's evil causes dejection, blues. Accordingly, always glorify jolly, friendly garfish. And so every summer, Colin went to Smart Kid Camp, and with each passing year, it became increasingly clear to him that he wasn't qualified to do anything, which is what he told Hollis Wells.
I just need you to be reasonably smart and not from Gutshot, and you both fit the bill. $500 a week for both y'all, plus free room and board. You're hired. Welcome to the Gutshot Textiles family.
Colin shot a glance at his friend, who held a quail daintily in his hands, his teeth gnawing at the bone in a vain search for a half-decent meal. Hassan placed the quail carefully back on the plate and looked back at Colin. Hassan nodded subtly. Colin's lips pursed. Hassan rubbed at his 5 o'clock shadow. Colin bit at the inside of his thumb. Hassan smiled. Colin nodded.
Okay, said Colin finally. They had decided to stay. Like it or not, Colin thought, road trips have destinations. Or at least his kind of road trip always would. And this seemed a fair endpoint. Sweet, if ceaselessly pink, accommodations. Reasonably nice people, one of whom made him feel slightly famous. And the home of his first ever Eureka. Colin didn't need the money, but he knew how much Hassan hated begging spending money off his parents. And also, they could both use a job. Neither of them, it occurred to Colin, had ever technically worked for money before. Colin's only worry was the theorem. Hassan said,
La urid an uzij riklatik, welakin min ajle khamzu. Mi et dular amriki fil uzbua, saufa afal.
Which means, I don't want to ruin your road trip, but for $500 American a week, I will.
La urid anksar kulal wakti min ajli watifa, Yajib an yashtavil, alamas alat, al riyadyat.
Or, the road trip has kind of sucked anyway, but I don't want the job to take my time. I need to do the theorem.
Can we just make sure Singleton has time to doodle? Asked Hassan in English.
Is that some kind of